Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Deputy Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
This week, we finally have the Surface Pro 10 and the Surface Laptop 6. Microsoft just held an event announcing those things, but they're not quite what we expected. They're not going to be sold in stores. They're going to be just for businesses. So we're going to dive into what's happening there, what's new in that hardware. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. Drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. So I feel like we've talked a lot about Surface devices, Sherlyn,
yeah.
And we were a little confused at Microsoft's fall event, where it ended up being mostly an AI event. We got the Surface Laptop Studio 2, the Surface Laptop Go 3, but not like the flagship devices from them. There was no Surface Pro tablet or anything. Now we finally have those, and it's also like, I was just a little confused when I saw Microsoft call the release these things, because they announced the Surface Pro 10 for business and the Surface Laptop 6 for business. And these are for business, for like Mr. Business, like something from, I don't know, some sort of comedy. Like that line in the name means they're not going to be sold in stores. And Microsoft did this to the Surface Go 4, I believe, last year, where you could buy it from their website. You could buy it from like corporate resellers, from people like who work for companies and buy equipment that way. But you can't buy it at Best Buy or Target or anything. That seems to be what's happening here. So just upon hearing that, Sherlyn, you know, when we heard this news, I talked to you and you found it a little odd too. What were your first impressions with what Microsoft is doing here?
I mean, yeah, like you said, right? This isn't Microsoft's first time launching a quote for business product. So I get it. I also started to kind of like have to like laugh because like, oh gosh, I guess the other publications that like announced this event were feeling a little, you know, it's underwhelming, right? Given all the hype that we saw from other, like, and we ourselves jumped on it. We're like, oh yeah, there's this Surface and AI event coming up. But then last week on, you know, last week's episode, you and I agreed. We were like, oh right, this is an Ignite. This is not really like the hype consumer focused event that we thought it was going to be. But that said, you and I, like you said, talked about this, and my instant reaction, you know, once I heard it was for business, was like, oh, I guess Microsoft is giving up. Like, is giving up on consumer products. Is giving up on consumer surfaces. I saw someone...
That would be your first impression, right?
Yeah. Right. I saw someone on Threads, and this would be my last word on this, but like someone on Threads was like, I've never seen the Surface out in the wild except for in sporting events, like NFL, like stadium, like, you know, ringside, I don't know, field side, fucking sports lingo. Anyway.
Sports
games, yeah. Ball games. Anyway, in those situations or like... one other scenario, and I can't quite remember. But, like, is that true? Have you seen Surfaces out in the wild? I thought I did.
In New York, I did, but not counting tech events where it's other tech journalists who may have a Surface review unit around. But in coffee shops and stuff, I've seen people walk around with Surfaces, but only in New York, never outside of, like, the big cities. Since I moved to Georgia, I have not seen a freaking Surface anywhere. It's mainly been Macs or other random PCs. So... yeah, that is kind of part of it. So once we heard this news, by the way, I reached out to Microsoft and we got a statement just because it seemed confusing. It seemed like, are you just giving up on consumer devices or what's happening here? I got a statement from Microsoft's spokesperson. They said, we absolutely remain committed to consumer devices. Building great devices that people love to use aligns closely with our company mission to empower individuals as well as organizations. We are excited to be bringing devices to market that deliver great AI experiences to our customers. This commercial announcement is only the first part of this effort. End quote.
Okay.
So that is where I'm like, okay, something is happening here. We do know the Surface, you know, developer conference is coming in a couple of months. That is in May. Microsoft has room to announce other things this year.
Right.
I'm just a little weird. Like, I was just a little confused by this strategy. And we should talk about these devices too. So Basically, broadly, it does seem like Microsoft is not giving up on consumer devices, even though there are a lot of arguments that maybe they should spend less time on Surface PCs. We just ran a piece, you know, around all those Xbox rumors. Aaron Sapores from Engadget wrote that they should maybe get out of the Xbox hardware business at some point. They're making some money from these things, but it's tough. It's tough to be on store shelves and do all these things. It does sound like something new is coming. And who knows what that is? That could be a Surface, like a true foldable. They killed the Surface Neo dual screen idea, but maybe that could be, you know, it could be the thing that comes eventually. Like, because we have seen a couple foldable PCs. We've seen a couple dual screen PCs by now. Sam Rutherford just reviewed the new Asus ZenBook Duo, which just has two big ass screens altogether. So maybe there is a new Surface coming that they're like just kind of waiting for a little bit. But let's talk about these computers. So both the Surface Pro 10 and the Surface Laptop 6 look exactly the same as the last new models, or it's the last models. The big difference is they both have new Core Ultra Intel CPUs, and those CPUs have the NPUs, so they can do AI work and use Windows Studio FX and all that. The Surface Pro 10 has the Core Ultra 5 135U or the Ultra 7 165U CPUs, and those are the like lower power ultra portable variants. The Laptop 6 has the H series versions of those same chips, so they're a little faster. They can both have up to 64 gigabytes of RAM, a terabyte of storage. What is interesting is that Microsoft shoved in a new webcam into the Surface Pro 10. So there's a 1440p webcam with, they're saying, the widest field of view we've ever seen in a laptop camera. It's 114 degree field of view, though, so that's pretty big. And that gives you room to do like cropping in or the face zooming and stuff like that. Like, it's high resolution, but it also gives the camera more space to like see the room. So that could be useful for some people. Weirdly, the Surface Laptop 6 is not getting that webcam, even though it has more room inside its hardware. It's getting a 1080p webcam, and also an optional ability to support smart card readers. Some people use those things for like secure authentication in offices, so I think that's the main play there. These are AI PCs, as Intel and AMD and other people are calling them. So they have the NPUs, they can run Windows Studio FX and other AI-related tasks that we'll be seeing from other developers, but that's... that's pretty much it. These are new chips in these computers. Both of them sorely needed some upgrades. Are you excited by just the existence of these new chips, Roland?
Look, I'm a big fan of the Surface Laptop series. I really like them. I think they look good. They're unique enough in, you know, in that they are not yet another MacBook clone. But I am already, I know this is the first time, well, not the first time, but like this is the first year maybe that these are being pushed, but I'm already so sick of AI PCs. Screw you. What is an AI PC? Is it just a PC with a processor that has an MPU? Because
That's what it is.
Yeah, but you've seen phones have MPUs for ages since Huawei announced like
they're not PCs. Something,
and we don't call them AI smartphones. You know what I mean? Like, what? This is marketing hype at its worst, in my opinion. Like, it's got MPUs, cool. I guess there's no better nomenclature. Mm-hmm. How do you Americans pronounce nomenclature? Nomenclature shall pass. I honestly, it's just more market. I tend to get angry at marketing. I think that's me. As far as like the actual specs and tech of it, I do think having, you know, CPU infrastructure that can handle dedicated AI tasks like that is a good thing. Is a good for future proofing. You know, it's high time Intel. You know, this sort of like, not necessarily big little infrastructure, but like had different dedicated like coprocessors or that sort of thing.
Yeah.
That didn't drain your battery that quickly. Or
Listen, I totally agree that the AI PC term is, you know, is marketing bluff, but also normal people do not sit here and look at specs, you know, and compare specs and see what's new. So I do feel like just having a badge that you can stick on a computer and being like, hey, can this do the new stuff I'm seeing? Can this do like background blurring without hurting my battery or something? That sounds new. Sounds different. It is like a functional that helps users. It does do new things.
And I mean, to your point, like the consumer isn't aware of like what the specs difference is. So to them, the difference needs to be clear. Like, what can an AI, so-called AI PC do that their existing laptop can't? And like, if you look at laptops from 2 or 3 years ago, they were already doing a lot of these things without being the branded AI PCs. Like Samsung laptops have been trying to beautify your face forever on a phone call, even though, you know, the dubiousness and, you know, moral.
Yeah, but they do that. So the difference is a lot of the work here can be done on your CPU or your GPU. But what that does is it kills your battery. So the nice thing about an MPU is that it is this like cool little chip that can do a lot of weird complex tasks without hitting the battery too much. So it's like it has like another brain. It's like an assistant for your CPU to do just like lower level tasks. And I think from what we've seen, there are legitimate like battery life gains by doing this. And also sometimes it's faster. So yeah, it's marketing, it's confusing. You know, that's a whole thing. I will say, just seeing these specs, I think these are like some healthy upgrades for these computers. I just find it interesting what Microsoft is deciding to do here, because they have not been making much money from Surface devices. When I've done Microsoft's earnings, the like Surface division has been getting like $2 billion worth of revenue, something like around there. By not having these computers in stores, that effectively makes them invisible to most users, right? Like nobody talks about the Surface Go 4, Sherlyn, because it's the Surface Go 4 for business, for Mr. Business, and it just doesn't exist. It's not in any conversation. So I fear that that may happen here. I also used to work in IT, like buying systems for a school, like buying hundreds of systems at a time. So that is kind of what they're aiming for here. Maybe they'll get higher, you know, higher margins like doing those things. But I also don't know why they can't do that and also get these things in Best Buy stores, because Surface PCs are still going to be in stores. It's just going to be the older models. So that's also kind of confusing.
It is. I think all of it is confusing. I think that we're already like, you know, better equipped than most consumers out there to like understand what's going on with all of this branding and AI stuff. And honestly, the more you confuse people, the less likely they're just going to buy your stuff and they'll go back to something familiar. So I don't think this bodes well.
Yeah. Like the MacBook is just, hey,
yeah,
MacBook.
Choose a size.
M3. M3 is bigger than M2. So right. I'm going to buy M3.
You choose
or
a
whatever.
Size. You choose Pro or not. Yeah. That's it.
That's it. It's pretty simple. You go to an Apple store, like you can touch and feel these things and just be like, oh, I hold this. I'm holding this. This is what I want. That's actually how I ended up deciding to go for the iPhone, you know, mm-hmm. Pro Max for mm-hmm. once, because I felt it was much better.
The magnesium was good. Yep.
The magnesium was good. Well, all that stuff is good, or the titanium is good on the iPhones, actually.
God, my bad, yeah.
I'm intrigued. I'm intrigued by these new computers, but I'm also, I feel like even more intrigued by what Microsoft has cooking next, because they're hinting at something. I don't feel like this is the best marketing strategy to sort of disappoint your more hardcore users or confuse them before you announce something new, whatever it ends up being. But we're going to stay in touch. Like, we're going to be reviewing these things still. If you guys have any questions about these computers, drop us an email at podcastandgadget.com. Got a couple other stats here. Microsoft says the Surface Pro 10 is 53% faster than the Pro 9 in 3D Mark Time Spy. That's because it's just using the newer Intel integrated graphics. The Surface Laptop 6 is twice as fast as before. The Laptop 6 gets the Intel Arc graphics, which are slightly better integrated graphics when you go to 16 gigabytes of RAM or more. So that's a big leap. I would not game on these computers, but you could do some basic stuff, it seems. So that's kind of cool. We don't have final pricing yet, from what I can see. They'll be going up for pre-order soon. Full disclosure, we are recording this officially before their websites are up and everything. So there's some details we don't fully know yet. But yeah, stay tuned. We'll be looking at these computers soon. And yeah, let us know if you're interested in them.
So it feels like a nothing burger, right, of the whole event. Now that we kind of know what was coming, the Surface and AI event, new era of work.
Well, yeah. They announced a bunch of like Copilot editions, like some changes happening for workplaces. And
wasn't there also an accessibility mm-hmm. update, by the way?
There was an accessibility update, but even then it's very little. So the accessibility update is they're going to be selling a Surface Pro keyboard with bolded keys. So it's like easier to see if you have, you know, low vision or any vision issues. There are the Surface accessibility, those accessories are going to be available to business customers now, because they weren't, like, you couldn't buy them through business channels before. So that's a good thing. That's a helpful thing. They're continuing the trend of like making accessibility a big highlight for Microsoft, but it's not huge. Beyond that, like, there's not much else going
right,
on.
Exactly.
So we have that news too. I don't know, folks. We will be keeping an eye out, and I'm interested in testing both these computers, so we'll hear back more soon. Let's move on to some other news. We saw this morning, almost out of nowhere, that the U.S. government has announced that it is suing Apple, accusing it of maintaining an iPhone monopoly. We saw a report of this actually last night, and I didn't know like when it was actually going to happen. But I'm looking at some details here. According to the New York Times, the lawsuit caps years of regulatory scrutiny of Apple's wildly popular suite of devices and services. This is something the U.S. government has been looking at for a while. The EU has looked at the iPhone's monopoly for a while, too. Sherlyn, you're covering mobile for us while also juggling so many other things now. Can you help us just like break this down real quick? And we just got this news, folks, so we're also still just processing it too.
Yeah. So like you said, Devendra, last night we saw a report that the DOJ was getting ready to file a lawsuit against Apple in federal court. And it did this morning. Like you said, that turnaround is quick. So the lawsuit, it accuses Apple of violating antitrust laws by making its hardware and software products largely inaccessible to competitors. And in question here is Apple's, quote, walled garden approach to business, which, you know, us in the industry, we use that term to refer to it. It makes it difficult for people to compete and switch. And I think that that's really a problem, right? Like, for example, we've seen Apple make switching over from Android to iPhone be very easy, but switching over from iPhone to Android is so difficult. You lose data. Like, what is it fair to a consumer to, like, lose data just because they switch phones? You got to question that sort of thing. I know, I will say, I think Apple had recently come out with a sort of feature that made it slightly easier to switch over to Android, but it would be, like, it conceding that these changes are coming. These sorts of lawsuits are coming. And we saw a lot of it start in the EU, where very recently the European Commission slapped Apple with a 1.8 billion euro fine, which is $1.95 billion in the US. And apparently this was specific to the music streaming thing, where it, you know, said that Apple was preventing music streaming developers from informing iOS users about alternative and cheaper subscription services available
specifically
outside
Spotify,
the App Store.
Spotify,
exactly. We talked about this in some of the earlier episodes. Now, in a press release, the Attorney General Merrick Garland, who is behind or the leading name in this lawsuit, said that Apple undermines apps, products, and services that would otherwise make users less reliant on the iPhone. Apple exercises its monopoly power to extract more money from consumers, developers, content creators, artists, publishers, small businesses, merchants, among others. It just, you know, goes on to state that, you know, Apple has illegally monopolized the software app market. So nothing that we weren't aware of, right?
Everything we've complained about, like we've talked about, like, hey, other fitness devices don't get the same level of like Bluetooth access, you know, or sensor access as the Apple Watch does. We've talked about whatever else, like the basically all the things that make iPhones a little special because they work only with Apple or they have a little bit of Apple magic. All those things work to reduce competition. And there are two arguments, right? Like, hey, this is Apple's platform, and the reason so many things can work so well is because they have such a strong control over everything. But also, I think there's a pretty strong argument, like, when you are now the largest smartphone platform, I believe they're shipping more than Android at this point, there's a certain responsibility to, like, being open to competition. And I think that is the hammer that is kind of dropping now, right?
And I do want to point out that we not only have seen the writing on the wall, we've also seen Apple start to make these concessions, start to adopt some of these practices, again, due to pressure from the EU to begin with, like, you know, embracing or having USB-C in the iPhone 15 series, you know, the adoption of RCS in messaging. You know, so there's a bit of a difference between the blue bubble, green bubble thing. But, you know, obviously, like we said, we don't think it's actually going away, the blue bubble, green bubble divide. But with these changes, if, you know, the DOJ's lawsuit goes through and there are actual changes implemented, then that divide could lessen. It might not be such a, you know, like, I secretly wonder if, like, Google had anything to do with this lawsuit. I'm just like, what? Did Samsung and Google go to be like, yo, we need to,
They're certainly helped by this, but, I mean, come on, like, Google has its own, like, antitrust issues with the government. Yeah. Samsung, I feel like this helps Samsung, right? So that's all good, but it is sort of like Apple has gotten to be so big that now that now, like, yeah, this is all kind of starting to fall a little for them. And I think it is fair to start asking, like, hey, you have this wonderful hardware, like, you should be giving people more access to lower level elements. Like, if you're so good, you should be able to compete on a fair level platform, yeah, right, with everybody else.
I have a question for you, Devendra.
Sure.
What do you think Apple said in response?
They said, no, we are great. And we are just trying to take care of you, our users. Everything we do is great. We can do no wrong. How dare you? I think it's basically
you got the gist of it, right? Yeah. Apple did issue a statement.
Because I know Apple.
Yeah. I will tell you, this Apple's statement suggests that the suit would hinder its ability to make the types of gadgets and software that made it one of the most valuable companies in the world. It also said that the suit, if successful, would set a, quote, set a dangerous precedent, empowering government to take a heavy hand in designing people's technology. So they're basically saying, yo, this lawsuit is successful, the government is overreaching, it's like that sort of thing. It's kind of what you said, but even more, like, you know, biting back at the government for, I guess, maybe the idea of interfering in the design of its products. But, I mean, I think Apple had to, like, fight back a little bit. I think that it couldn't just be like, yeah, okay, we'll take the suit. So, this seems like pretty, like, typical tennis style back and forth, you know what I mean?
And this is how a healthy economy works, right? It's like we cannot let these companies, as great as they may be at times, and they certainly know the tech better than anybody else, they are not aware of how their actions affect the wider markets all the time, and they will, as a profit-seeking, you know, entity, will do whatever it can to get as much money from them. Like, we also saw the report that Microsoft, Meta, and Google are also protesting their decision to charge developers, even for when you're going using outside payment processors. They're still charging developers like a certain pretty high percentage, yep, almost close to the 30%. And they're kind of protesting that, being like, that seems unfair if you are actually opening up your platform. This pushback is normal. This is like, you know, these are the market forces people love to talk about so much at work. Sometimes, like, I think regulation is a good thing, because it is, people don't remember like what Microsoft used to do in its heyday and what a lot of other companies did. Like, Microsoft used to like destroy small software companies because they were a potential threat to Windows. And that it was kind of a dirty time, and that's why they, like, the DOJ cracked down real hard on the Internet Explorer in the late 90s because of Microsoft's whole history of doing this. So we're kind of back in this time where now Apple is dominant and they're wielding their force as much as possible. And sometimes you don't do this anymore. But if you had a dog, you know, if you had a puppy or something, is doing something bad, kind of just give it a little whap. And this is what the DOJ is doing. It's like a little whap on the nose. Please don't. Please don't.
Talking about the DOJ, I want to contextualize this a little bit and bring up to me a fun fact. This was a federal antitrust enforcement and 16 attorneys general that are involved, who all said that that Apple's anti-competitive practices extend beyond the iPhone and Apple Watch businesses. You know, it covers also their advertising, their browser, their FaceTime, and news products. And I want to say the complaint was filed in the District of New Jersey. Woohoo!
Okay.
Anyway,
I
know.
So now you're repping New Jersey? I thought you were calling yourself a New Yorker.
I am now a proud New Jersian.
You can't be both.
Only the Jersey City little area. I don't claim to own the rest of them. Anyway, Apple shares also fell since the news was announced this morning, of over 2%, which is pretty big. The Justice Department, in its release, said that in a move to keep consumers buying iPhones, Apple moved to block cross-platform messaging apps, limited third-party wallet and smartwatch compatibility, and disrupted non-app store programs and cloud streaming services. Now, I think that blocking cross-platform messaging apps doesn't seem completely accurate. I know that specifically they're talking about SMS and like iMessage, but, you know, Telegram, Signal, WhatsApp have all been available on iPhones.
Sure, but sure, I can't iMessage on my Windows computer.
Exactly.
I'm sitting right here.
Right.
Yeah.
Specific to iMessage, that is valid. But exactly the things about the third-party stores that you can download in the you can use in the EU already now. These are things that I think if we look over, you know, across the pond, sort of, we can start to see if the lawsuit is successful, what changes might start to happen over here in America, for iPhone users, right? Like, it feels as if some of the changes we're seeing there at first seemed a little distant, like we might never get them, but it seems like now we're closing in on that, right?
I think so. And also, like, Apple has been, like, continually responding to the EU, you know, pressure against them. Like, they have been changing App Store rules almost, like, weekly. They're like, okay, we're going to restrict, like, exactly what you could do when you're downloading something from the web. But I believe they just did an update. I got to look this back up. But they basically will announce a set of restrictions. Everybody will complain. And Apple will be like, okay, we're changing our mind. We're doing it this way because they don't want to get fined again. So this is definitely pressuring Apple. Like, they are feeling the pain. That big EU fine is certainly, like, a memorable thing for them. So,
oh, for sure.
I guess we'll see. But, you know, it is important for our governments to also be paying attention to, like, what these companies are doing with the power that they're building up. So this is all, like, a good, healthy back and forth, I'd say. But we can move on to another piece of news, because we also saw at the beginning of the week is that Apple reportedly is tapping Google for Gemini AI to bring that into iPhones. This likely won't replace what the other, like, AI models and things Apple is working on. It sounds like they may be using Gemini for remote AI calls. So almost like the way they're tapping into Google right now for search. You don't search via an Apple search engine. You search via Google on Safari and every single Apple device. And for that privilege, Google is paying Apple, by the way, to have that increased FaceTime, because to have more users equals more money for Google, too, ultimately. Like, those are more ad impressions.
Another area where there's competitive practices.
Yep. That's also, like, ruining online media. Like, we can talk about all that stuff. But the gist here is it feels like Apple may be considering essentially expanding its partnership with Google to make Gemini search kind of the next step or something built into iPhones. The on-device stuff, just from the reporting, this is from Mark Gurman over at Bloomberg, it does sound like Apple has its own on-device models that's going to be working on, which makes total sense. We have heard that they're working on all sorts of stuff. They could be balancing a whole combination of things, right? The on-device models will do stuff like give you real-time transcriptions and things like that, like doing actual work on your system. But when you're, like, asking a broader question or querying the web or something, it needs to reach out to something. And it just sounds like they're going to say, hey, Gemini, can you answer this question for me? We don't quite know what form this will take. Like, this could be a future form of Siri. I don't know. Do you think, like, will users even know, like, hey, Siri is going to Gemini to answer this question? Will it even be transparent? Probably won't be.
I don't think so. I think at most you'll see, like, a little visual cue if, like, it's displaying web results after it. You know, you ask a question that doesn't have the answer in its knowledge database to respond with. But that seems like something they might have to work out in their contract, because I feel like I don't believe Google will be happy to not get credit visually for its results.
I mean, they will get eyeballs. Like, they will get their results going to other people. So
I think
maybe that's it.
Mm-hmm. I was more like, oh, wow. Like, I mean, we know they've collaborated in a way that, like, Google has to pay Apple for, you know, the Safari ranking or the search bar thing.
Built-in search, yeah.
Right, exactly. But it was just, oh, are they actually collaborating? Is this Apple conceding? And Apple does need to realize, and it probably does know, that its AI is just nowhere near the likes of Google or Microsoft. And they're far from the big players in that space. And so tapping Gemini is actually a smart move, in my opinion. I just think maybe the payments should go the other way.
I mean, it just makes complete sense, right? I don't think Apple will be tapping OpenAI to get, like, that stuff, to get GPT, to get ChatGPT stuff within Macs and within iPhones, because it's like that is essentially Microsoft's baby now. Like, Microsoft owns 49% of OpenAI. They have such a close partnership. Satya Nadella went to bat for Sam Altman, you know, like. Mm-hmm. I feel like the camp is sort of like, well, Apple's like, okay, well, that's a relationship we can't really touch. You know, it doesn't really help us to offer the same thing that Windows does. So this is sort of like, okay, we have this other, Google's very good. They're trustworthy. We know them. Maybe a volatile startup is not the best place to lay billions of dollars into at this point. It's a safer Apple-y choice. It is an enemy that they know, right?
Oh, rather so Google's than, just better at mobile stuff than Microsoft. I mean, again, they're both not great, but like Google is just ever so slightly better at mobile stuff.
Well, is this mobile because this is search? This is
I just think of AI it as being search, on iPhones and that sort of stuff. So, but it's also probably elsewhere. But
yeah. Anyway, the reporting says that no deal has been struck yet. Google or Apple could end up working together with OpenAI or other people too. Anthropic was another name they were throwing around. So it could be that they have multiple things. Like they could be using Gemini for text search and like other things like that. But maybe for image creation, Apple could be tapping somebody else. Like maybe they would use DALL-E for something like that. So who knows?
One last note, right? Like, I will say that after all of this stuff around the DOJ and Apple, you know, working with Google / other potential AI partners, I will say that, like, Apple seems to be, like, the least shitty company about your data, right? Like, privacy seems to be one of its, like, biggest concerns. So even if Apple is having like this sort of monopoly, and even though you know it's rightly coming under scrutiny for its like antitrust and anti-competitive practices, it still has been able to do some good things with like protecting our data privacy. Like for example, I was going to say that like Siri tends to be faster and more responsive than the Google Assistant or like some other voice-based like assistants, right?
I don't know. Debatable.
On my iPhone, I will say this. It's like now the wake word is just Siri, and somehow iPhones are
awful,
smart
by
enough.
The way. I hate it.
Okay, sure. I use
too many
it, right?
words that are just like Siri or sound a little bit like that.
Okay,
like,
it works really well for me though. I've said it at least twice just out loud right now. My phones have not responded, but when I am like definitely going to say the hot word because I want a query, like I want something from it, it is responsive and it responds quickly. Because I recently tested out, and I can't say it yet, tested out another AI assistant type thing, and that thing was like so slow. I was just like, oh, I actually do appreciate that, you know. And I know why Siri is faster, because it's already like it pre-processed some of your like query ahead of time. So it's already gotten half of your question before the bubble appears on screen.
And they're doing a lot on device now.
Exactly. So a lot of that processing is fast.
Yeah.
But at the same time, because even though it's listening to me ahead of time, I'm okay with Apple doing that, because I know Apple truly isn't actually going to store that data. Like I had this weird level of trust with Apple on that. And I do trust Google with that too, but Google doesn't execute it as well all the time.
Google is a data storage company. They build their business on collecting your data and reselling your data.
And you find out
so,
over and over again that Google stores this data for, you know, anyway. So I just want to say that like in terms of Apple working with Google maybe or Gemini on AI type things for various reasons or platforms that like in – it will just benefit Apple, and I think I feel as if I can trust Apple to be like quite responsible with how it handles the data processes and queries. So
I mean, all these companies suck on multiple levels for other reasons, but at least Apple's like really laying into the security thing. They say they're not sending data back to their own servers. It is happening encrypted on device. Like that stuff, that's really all we can work off of.
Yes.
But in general, I think they've been pretty good about it. So anyway. We will hear more. I would love to know what our listeners think, though. Like, what do you want to hear from, you know, what do you want to see when it comes to AI stuff on iPhones? It almost feels like Apple just has to do something, right? They have to do something because the prevailing narrative over the last year is that they've been slow to AI, even though they've had MPUs in iPhones for a while. They've had, you know, they've had AI processors. They've had neural processors is what they've been calling them. But the idea is that they're slow, so they have to show that, hey, there are copilots everywhere on Windows. We have this AI built into Siri. We're not behind. You know, Apple's never behind. Please. How dare you? Again, how dare you? Everything Apple does is basically a how dare you
say
we're slow to AI. That's essentially what it feels like. Speaking of AI news, by the way, we saw that NVIDIA unveiled its new basically like high-level GPUs, the Blackwell GPUs, which will be powering AI for future systems. They're saying they are 30 times faster than NVIDIA's previous H100 chips. And these are not the GPUs going into like gaming systems to play games. These are the things in data centers, the things in servers to really crunch a lot of AI workloads. And these are the things essentially powering the AI revolution. So Blackwell is our new one. Some stats here. Pranav Dixit from Engadget wrote this up for us. Let me see here. They're named after David Harold Blackwell, a mathematician who specialized in game theory and statistics. NVIDIA claims it is the world's most powerful chip, like full stop. So that is potentially interesting. NVIDIA is also known to inflate numbers and stats and things like that. But listen, like, you look at the rise of NVIDIA over the last 5 years after everybody has been leaning on AI and just seeing like how high their market cap and how high their value has climbed. They're not lying about that. You know, that is something that is a thing. Let me see here. It offers a significant performance upgrade to AI companies with speeds of 20 petaflops compared to just 4 petaflops that the H100 provided. Much of this speed is made possible thanks to the 208 billion transistors in Blackwell compared to 80 billion in H100. To achieve this, NVIDIA connected two large chip dies that could talk to each other at speeds up to 10 terabytes per second. So that is also something, you know, connecting chips together to get a ton more, to deal with a ton more workloads. That's essentially what Apple's doing with like the their Ultra chips too. So, hey, it's just raw power, raw AI power. This means nothing to consumers right now, but it also means like future AI services, whatever the next GPT is. I think we saw the rumor that GPT-5 may launch this summer. These will likely be using NVIDIA hardware in whatever server setups they're in. So something we will be paying attention to. Other chip news, Intel got the biggest amount of funding from the federal government from the CHIPS Act. They're getting $8.5 billion. Again, this is something... it's going to be a big deal for AI. It's going to be a big deal for Intel's manufacturing, too. Let me see. Marielle Moon wrote for us that money will go towards the chipmaker's efforts to expand its manufacturing facilities in the U.S., particularly plants designed to make leading-edge semiconductor chips meant for use in AI and other advanced applications. So more chips being built in the U.S., that is essentially the whole point of the CHIPS Act, so that we are not relying as much on Chinese chipmakers and also not as much on Taiwanese chipmakers, too. Like TSMC, I believe they're working to launch something here, too. But essentially, all the major chips, all the major mobile chips have relied on TSMC in Taiwan, right? It's just like this one company on a little island that China wants to take over. Like, yeah. It is such a precarious situation that our entire mobile market is built on. Just wild. I mean, any thoughts? Yeah.
I tuned into this briefing because I was actually on news when it was happening and very intrigued by everything that was put out on the call and sort of the backgrounding and the contextualizing of why this CHIPS Act is and that funding is going to Intel, which is that, yes, you know, trying to get protective and trying to bring all of this like important assembly and manufacturing like lines and factories back into the U.S. And they're going to have, you know, fabrication facilities constructed in 4 states, including Arizona, Ohio, New Mexico, and Oregon are some of the existing fabs as well. A lot of the stuff that the sense that I was getting, I mean, AI was thrown around a lot during that briefing, which is like, yeah, we need to like bring this in. The other thing I was getting is like a case of national security almost, right? It's like, yeah, we need to like protect these interests almost. Also, I am reminded forcibly of that chip shortage that we were going through during the pandemic and wondering if this, you know, could help in future if that happens again. But I mean, that's really hard for me to predict, but I'm just like, okay, that's a lot of money, but you know, Intel is an interesting choice in my opinion, but I guess that was really the main US option.
I mean, that's pretty much them. Like, yeah. You know,
everyone else is Chinese, Taiwanese, elsewhere.
Yes. Yes. You have AMD, you have NVIDIA, you have Intel, right? And then you have the mobile manufacturers.
Qualcomm.
Too, so. Qualcomm. Oh yeah, we have Qualcomm. That's true. Really, we love a Qualcomm, don't we? Kind of related to all this AI stuff, by the way, and all the chip news is we saw that Microsoft has hired the DeepMind co-founder, Mustafa Suleiman. DeepMind, if you'll remember, like, did you ever do a lot of like DeepMind reporting, Trillin?
I mean, some, not a lot at all, like some server-related like, stuff, yeah.
It was one of those things where like Google, it was essentially an AI company, but it was an early AI company, and Google bought them, and I feel like, or what was it? Did it spin off from Google? I have to like look up the full thing.
It could have been one of those like Alphabet investments.
2014. Right. Yeah, they bought DeepMind in 2014. I'm seeing that. But that is 2014. I remember reporting on tech stuff, like and reporting on NVIDIA's AI stuff for years and being like, this is not real. I don't know what any of this is. And it wasn't until the ChatGPT stuff started that we were taking it seriously. It was a thing consumers could actually touch and feel. But all of this work, like where we are right now, would not have happened without a lot of the work happening at DeepMind and elsewhere. So the co-founder of that company is now at Microsoft. He is the CEO of Microsoft AI, which is a whole new division. They're going to be leading the development of Copilot. So that's kind of fascinating too, because it feels like Microsoft has been leaning so much on OpenAI for all of its stuff that it didn't really have much smarts of its own. So I guess this makes sense, right?
It needed an in-house expert, I think. And this is a smart hire, it seems like, because again, DeepMind is one of the leaders in the space, in my opinion. I just want to point out though, Devendra, when you said like back in 2014 is when they spin off, I was like, mm-hmm.
Or when
holy
they were purchased,
crap.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. When they were purchased, sorry. I was like, whoa, that's 10 years ago.
That's Jesus. 10 years ago.
I was like looking, I was like, is that 7 years ago? I was like, no, it's a whole ass 10 years ago.
It's 10 years ago. Time moves really fast. Boy. You know, we're all going to date ourselves. But it is fascinating. Like, I've been looking at this market for a while. I've been covering, that was back when I was covering Google more closely. And a lot of this stuff just felt like a magic box. You know, like Google will spend hundreds of billions of dollars on this company that may or may not produce something interesting at some point. And now kind of the fruits of that labor is finally happening. It's finally arriving. So interesting for Microsoft. I am still not fully convinced on the whole AI, all the things with Copilot or like Copilot, all the things. Still not convinced Microsoft knows what it's doing there. I've been testing Copilot Pro for a while and like it's fine. It's totally, it's a cool little toy. You know, I need a picture of my son, you know, for his second birthday party and like put him driving a little fire truck and it's cute. That's a very cool thing. I don't know. That's not worth $20 a month. And I also don't know like how often people will need things like that. But it's cool, I guess.
Speaking of like Microsoft, Apple, and Google all having events and doing things in the AI space, Google announced this week I.O. 2024 is happening on May 14th, at least kicking off on May 14th, and then lasting a couple days after that. We, in the prep for this episode, Devendra, remember when I said Google AIO?
Google AIO.
AIO. I mean,
that's
yo,
where,
Google.
That's free, what it all feels
free
like.
Free idea
now.
Right there. It's not free. You need to credit me. But IO is happening May 14th at the Shoreline Amphitheater, as it was last year. We expect to see, I think, probably even more AI from Google. And knowing Google, it's probably going to have more consumer-facing things than the likes of, I don't know, Copilot or DeepMind, whatever. Speaking of, Google also had another event this week. Jesus, it's been a week, Devendra. I don't know if you feel the
what
same
a week.
Way.
What a week.
What a week. Yeah. But Google had this sort of like commercial, not really consumer-facing event called the Check Up with Google Health, where it basically, at least for the general population, had some news to share that was really just letting us know the availability of things that we knew were coming. So for example, remember at I.O. last year, speaking of I.O., Fitbit was supposed to have a chatbot coming soon within the mobile app. So basically, it is arriving later this year. Now we have a date, I guess. And it will be only available initially, at least, to Fitbit Premium subscribers with Android devices that are enrolled in the Fitbit Labs program. So in short, still a longer time to wait, but at least not an unknown date at this point. Some features that we saw introduced to Google Lens last year, for example, like using the Lens app or the Lens feature to take a photo of your skin and find visually similar matches for skin conditions. Like you have a rash and you don't know what it is. Is it bed bug bites or is it just a heat rash, you know? That feature is now available in over 150 countries. So like if you didn't know the words to describe pink bumps or like raised lumps or something, you can just use the camera on your phone. So, you know, minor-ish in terms of news, but, you know, maybe for people who need these sorts of tools, it's nice to know that they're now available. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, if we're talking still about Google, YouTube also, by the way, announced this week, it has new rules for, quote, realistic-looking AI-generated videos. Quote is around the word realistic. So if your AI-generated video is clearly unrealistic, so I guess it's like cartoon or animation, you won't need to include a disclosure. But according to the new rules that YouTube laid out this week, is that realistic looking videos that are made with altered or synthetic media, including generative AI, will have to label it for the sake of transparency. And YouTube's definition of realistic content is anything that a viewer could, quote, easily mistake, end quote, for an actual person, event, or place. I mean, right? Again, it feels like responsible thing
we need to be doing this. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Disclosures are good. Transparency is good. This is going to hopefully help.
Well, listen, we can relate this to something we're going to be talking about later in this episode, Trillin. Like, I actually pushed this down in our show notes because, like, it will tie directly into a little bit of a fiasco happening in the UK. But before we get there, we do want to mention the news that Glassdoor is reportedly attaching real names to anonymous accounts. This is a crazy story. If you are, this is just like a PSA. If you have left a review for your old employer,
yeah,
or your current employer, maybe go back and take a look at your Glassdoor accounts. Apparently, after the company bought Fishbowl in 2021 and integrated it, Glassdoor users get signed up for a Fishbowl account, and as a result, they have to be verified. I don't exactly know what Fishbowl is.
Me neither.
Basically, this. If you've had a previously anonymous account with Glassdoor and you sign up for the Fishbowl thing, your identity is linked. And there are people who are saying that, you know, their name was attached to anonymous reviews. One manager said that there was no way to be anonymous anymore, although a Glassdoor spokesperson told Ars Technica that you could still be fully anonymous. Just be careful out there. I think Glassdoor is like one of those like really useful services because the idea of having completely anonymous, but also verify that maybe you were actually at that company.
Right.
But having feedback about a company, something that LinkedIn wouldn't do, right? It's like a little too hot for LinkedIn almost.
Yeah. It's like reviews for a company, useful. Right? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And LinkedIn has reviews, but it's not quite the same. It doesn't like let you rate the level of compensation and how you felt about the company. So anyway, just be careful about your Glassdoor stuff.
I will say that two things about this piece. One is that like the reason I like was including this in today's episode is that like my best friend sent it to me. She was like, "What the hell?" I was like, "Oh, right." The other thing it reminded me of is like I've been looking at Engadget's Glassdoor ever since this article went up. And I was like, oh, what are our reviews like? And I mean, like people seem to be like okay with Engadget, which is great. I am personally okay with it, at least for the most part. I was just like, oh, wouldn't it be nice to see who left these ratings of Engadget on Glassdoor? See,
the power's corrupting you, Trillin. You're like, who would be? Yeah, you want to know the goss, basically. Exactly.
I feel like, are you from 8 years ago or are you from 2 years ago? You know what I mean? Like, it's a bit of a difference, but anyway.
It's kind of the fun. I mean, that is, hey, if you're looking for a job or something, always look at the Glassdoor. Look at how people feel about companies. I think, like, moving into a company, even if they're going to pay you more, but the experience of working there is going to be hellish and not great. Like, a bad manager can certainly kill a good-sounding job on paper. So just be careful as you're Glassdooring out there, folks. I want to hear, Trillin, like, you had some thoughts on the whole Kate Middleton thing and the photo touching, the photo retouching and everything. This kind of reminded me of the AI-generated warnings too. Like, people started going back and look. So, first of all, frame the issue. What the hell is going on? Because I've learned too much about this, and I'm trying not to.
But you've learned it against
your will. Everyone is talking about it. God damn it.
All right, so this is exactly the sort of drama I enjoy keeping up with and somehow just like naturally absorb it through my Reddit, scrolling. So anyway, what happened is about a couple weeks ago. Okay, no, start from way earlier. I think earlier this year, maybe in January, February, I can't quite remember exactly when, Princess/Duchess of Kensington in the UK, Kate Middleton, more famously maybe Prince William's wife and mother of his children disappeared from public eye for a bit because she apparently had abdominal surgery and then was just never quite seen in public after. And so 2 weekends ago was Mother's Day in the UK, and the royal, like the Kensington Palace, which is different from the like King's Palace, which is Buckingham Palace.
I hate
the Kensington
all this.
Palace, which is the prince and duchess's in charge, released a picture, right? Like, oh, happy Mother's Day. Here's a picture of Kate with her three kids. They're smiling, they're happy, etc. And everyone was like, cool, it was nice to see her. I think, you know, you want to be immediately like, be like, oh yeah, it's a cool, it's nice to see her healthy, right? But then like people started to realize the image looks sus as F. So for me, at first when I saw the picture, I was like, it looks fine. I mean, it just seems like a little crowded or something. But then I watched this TikTok
boring.
Video.
Yeah.
This person who broke it the F down. And I let me just tell you. You zoom in and you notice like bits of a person's arm are missing, the color of a shirt looks really off, and somehow it bleeds over into an undershirt somehow. Just kind of sloppy stuff. And this TikTok person also like connected some dots saying that like if you look at what they're wearing in this picture and compared to the last time this family was seen in public, they look like they're wearing the same exact clothes except for like different colors. And it seems like someone had done a sloppy Photoshop job of like changing up the color of the clothes to make it seem plausible that this photo was taken recently, i.e. Kate Middleton was in good health recently, right? Here's where the tech aspect of it comes in. So you've got the metadata of the picture says that the picture was captured on a Canon camera, etc. And when the Kensington Palace Twitter account or whichever social media they were using tweeted out this photo, they were like, picture by Prince William with the Canon, whatever. And so then this picture was, you know, obviously published also by, you know, well-renowned publications like The Telegram, The Guardian, etc. The best part of this all came when the Telegraph? One of those, I'm sorry, the telly something, was like, kill order for this picture. It is super edited. We can't use it. So blah, blah, blah. And then it just kind of escalated from there, right? Everywhere else was like, oh, look at all the manipulations, blah, blah, blah. Then you had like the AFP, which is again, one of the best like wire services in the world, was like, we no longer trust Kensington Palace as a source of information. Then they had someone, whoever it was, like Kensington Palace PR, had like someone put out a notice that said like Kate Middleton was like, oh, you know, I enjoy photography. I enjoy editing pictures as much as anyone else. You know, I did the editing, something like that. So like basically very shady looking, suspicious looking stuff. It all happened sort of over a weekend because again, it was Mother's Day on 2 weekends ago. So it was like on a Sunday. So on our news desk, it was hard to kind of like just keep up and have us cover it. But by the time it was kind of all blown over on Monday, we were just hearing that nobody trusts Kensington PR, Kensington Palace. And then Getty, most recently this week, flagged another British royal family photo and said in its sort of metadata type caption field that this picture had been digitally altered. And so it's just if y'all have seen the British sitcom, not sitcom, but comedy series, The Thick of It, this feels so much like bureaucratic idiocy and just really bad. It's also, don't even get me started on the video that was released this week of like Kate Middleton walking like somewhere, carrying a heavy grocery bag, walking with Prince William, smiling. Everyone's like, that doesn't look like her. That looks like Rose Hanbury, a lot of people said. And I was like, that looks nothing like Rose. Please stop. It looks like her, but like thinner. She must have been like recovering from surgery. Maybe she... People were like, her height doesn't look right. She's, you know, everyone now just doesn't believe Kensington PR. So anyway, I think the moral of the story is that if you're going to edit anything or digitally alter anything, if you're not transparent, people will know. People on the internet are smart. And so when they find out, you will inevitably be discovered. When people find out and realize you've not been transparent about something, your credibility just goes out the window. For anything from now, moving forward. Because you can look at the repercussions for Kensington, right? Not about Buckingham. Because Buckingham like did other stuff to make it look like Prince King Charles is still alive in spite of everything. Kensington has lost all credibility, right? And so like it is, I think, sort of the boy who cried wolf, almost sort of a fable for Kensington. That gives me hope for our future. Because like, yes, people can be dumb and naive, but then there are people who will call this stuff out and there are people who will be like,
well, people with too many technical skills. But also like, you're talking about the good side of it, Sherlyn. I also feel like the, I don't know, this is a whole thing, it's not really engaged, but the whole hype of it, the obsession with it,
right,
is
with
just
the
like, you're just, guys, they're just stupid rich people who have been who are rich now because of the wealth of the generations before them and all the inbreeding and all the stuff they have stolen from other cultures and countries. Like, yeah, there's a lot going on there. Did you talk about like them blaming Kate Middleton for part of this? Sherlyn?
Yeah, the part where she had to like, the tweet went out and it was like, not a tweet, it was just like a post. I can't remember if it was Instagram or whatever, but it was words, right? Saying that like, she
it was a statement. Yeah,
claimed ownership of the editing failures, where everybody was just like, Did she? Like, was it her?
No.
Was it you? And then it was like, and the whole William of it all is like, he seems so like removed from it. Nobody like stepped up to defend her publicly. No one's made a statement in front of actual
cameras. Well, there's a whole parallel storyline going on about his mistress. And that's also where I'm like, Rose this Hambry, is all yeah. very stupid.
Don't,
and
I don't. Listen.
Yes.
There's wow. also like the British media are in cahoots with the palace sometimes, because if you look at like the, in between the video of her walking the streets and the initial like claiming, you know, owning the guilt of like the initial edited picture. There was one picture that was released of her and Will in a car. And it was one of those grainy pap shots from very far away. And her face like turned away from the camera. So you can't even really tell it's her, right? Here's the thing. Some outlets use that initial, like the actual like recent photo taken in 2024 as the like picture. The Sun, for some reason, was like, for our thumbnail, we're going to use this picture of Kate smiling at the camera from the car. Like, she is alive and healthy. And that's not, that was taken years ago, like a year or so ago. And it's just so misleading, so wrong.
This is like the exact worst time to be like the British royals, like just trying to obfuscate something. And I'm sure like the actual news is like, they are being weird and ableist because maybe she's a little sick because she's recovering from surgery.
Right.
But you can't be not perfect in this in this family. You have to be perfect. So there were stories going back. Like, people were tracing photo ads back like decades, like back into like black and white photo eras, you know, of like the edits that they have done to make the royal seem more perfect. So I'm not surprised. Everybody, professional photos are edited all the time. It just seems like this was the exact bad time, especially now that everyone's like, how many fingers do you have? Do your teeth look real? Are you AI or are you not? Like, we are also like hypersensitive now.
Yeah.
It's just the exact worst time to be doing this. So anyway, thank you, Sherlyn, for breaking this down. Anything you want to add about this whole fiasco?
I mean, it's ongoing and it's I love the chaos. I welcome everyone to like send me any more updates, any little like manipulation artifacts that you see. Just send them to me. I love it.
I just want this all to be over.
So this week, like I said, has been incredibly busy, and so has our team. Around in Gadget this week, we've got pieces from our anniversary package. In case you forgot, we are turning 20 or just have turned 20, turned 20 this month. So a few pieces from people like Dan Cooper. This was actually last week, but we neglected to mention it last week. He had a piece about chatbots, which promise a future that will never arrive. Carissa Bell this week published YouTube Created the Creator Economy. This is really our look back on the last 20 years in tech. So take a look. It's all, you know, I think a really nice retrospective on the time since Engadget was born. Dan also published a piece this week about Lotus, the EV maker, and it says Lotus's secret weapon is EVs with personality. We love Dan's spicy takes, and yeah, you need personality. A lot of these EVs these days just look like the same bland or overly futuristic vehicles. So it's nice to see Lotus try a different approach. Speaking of vehicles, Matt went hands-on with a new all-road e-bike from Cowboy and took it for a ride. This bike, unfortunately, is only available in the UK, but you know, I'm someone who's like looking at mobility devices for this very short commute that I take from my home to the gym. I walk up a hill. I hate it. So I might be looking at e-bikes. And if you are, and if you're in the UK, check out Matt's hands-on that went up yesterday. I don't know why there's just so much car coverage this week, but we also
lots
have
cars.
Lots of cars and bikes. Tim Stevens, who contributes to our site, especially on his car stuff, is, you know, back with a video and short post on BMW's Vision Neue Klasse X. It's a concept SUV from BMW.
It's beautiful. Yeah.
Good Lord. I watched that video. I was like, I want to be in this car so bad.
It is a very hot car.
Very cute, yeah. Very hot. Just pretty. And apparently this version of the Neue Klasse concept is closer to production than ever before. I mean, that's kind of a duh thing to say, but like, it's pretty close. So this is a good look at it. Check out the video on our YouTube. And then finally, this week we launched our spring cleaning package. And also, not to forget, Amazon had a big spring sale because Amazon can't do enough sales, I guess. But anyway, if you're looking for deals, we have a lot of that coverage. In tandem, we have our spring cleaning package, including Matt Smith's story, how to clean your AirPods, that's been updated to be a bit more modern and up-to-date today. Amy on our team has pieces on how to make your smartphone last longer, as well as how to refurbish your old tech. So, you know, worth checking out, and also generally just good for the environment, I think. Oh, and I saved the best for last.
Okay.
Devendra.
Oh, yeah.
Reviewed an Alienware monitor. Dev, do you want to tell us about it?
Yeah. I mean, listen, I've been talking about this for a while. I've had the Alienware 32-inch 4K QD OLED. This is their new flagship screen. Go check out my review, because this thing is like a perfect monitor. It is $1,290.
How dare you say perfect, but yes.
$1,200. It is a very good monitor. It's super bright, super fast, great colors. It's freaking beautiful OLED. The only downside is that it's not an ultra wide, and I'm just so ultra wide pilled at this point. Like, I kind of want just a little more screen space to dock windows and stuff while I'm podcasting. So that's the only thing. But as a gaming monitor, good God, it's glorious. So check out my review of this new Alienware 4K QD OLED monitor. Let's move on to our pop culture picks for the week. What do you got, Sherlyn?
I mean, it's one of those weeks where it's not a pick, probably, but more of a here's what I'm watching and judge me if you want. And Devendra, you're going to judge me, maybe. I recently rewatched and watched for the first time the entire Night at the Museum trilogy. Did you know?
What?
Night at the Museum.
Did you find this on the Criterion Collection?
No. Stop. This, like, so
I'm like a special box set of Disney Plus. Fine cinema.
I know, right? Yeah, it's such. My taste is impeccable.
How did you even? There were three of them.
That's the thing. Did you know there were three? Good I didn't God. Even know. I okay. okay so I rewatched the first one just to be like, oh, nostalgia, it was cute,
just to catch yourself up on
just to be like, oh, lore. How are museums back in the day, you know, because a museum of a museum, if you will. And then I watched the second one because why not, you know, like. And then at the like you may also like section of Disney Plus, I saw there was a whole third one. This is a whole trilogy, an entire trilogy. Star Wars, look out, you know what I mean.
Let me ask you, did you leave your house at all while on this Night at the Museum marathon? Was this just you just
spent
like the
night
for a whole day?
I spent the night at the Sherzium, you know, I spent at home.
Yeah, exactly. I envision exactly how this went down, Trillin, is like you sat down to start a movie and you're like, well, next one. Well, third one.
Exactly.
And all of a sudden, 6 hours later,
You know
still
what?
On
if only
couch,
they
so.
Made a National Treasure trilogy, like I want a third Nicolas Cage treasure.
There
hunter.
Are two of them, right? Yeah. So those are fun.
Those are so
more
good.
Fun
I love
than
them.
Night at the Museum. More fun than the Da Vinci Code.
Yes, okay. But I will shout out that I think Steve Coogan was actually a surprise in the National Museum. National
He's
Museum.
He's hilarious. Yeah.
Night at the Museum. I blame
Night
those.
At the Museum.
Night at the Museum trilogy. Yeah. He, like, I didn't even remember he was in it. So I rewatched it. I was like, wait, that's Steve Coogan? He's the, like, one of the little models that acts alongside Owen Wilson. Basically, they're like besties. And he is hilarious
he's
in a way that
fun.
I wasn't expecting.
He is a great comedian that's never fully clicked in the U.S., I think. But he
is
great
weird.
In supporting roles. Yeah.
So I remember him specifically for like the Alan Partridge role, which is a very specific vibe. And his Night at the Museum character is nothing like that, which just goes to show how versatile he can be. So there you go.
Let it be known that Sherlyn spent 6 hours watching Night at the Museum movies when we have given her gold recommendations for the past,
don't even.
Like,
I
years.
Finished the trilogy and I went right back to the first one and started again. So
I don't. Anyway, let's talk about a good new thing.
Give me a good one.
I do want to recommend the movie Love Lies Bleeding. This is a cool new like erotic noir thriller directed by Rose Glass, starring Kristen Stewart and somebody who I think everyone's going to be paying attention to, Katie O'Brien, a super cool, just like jacked as hell lady. Like this movie is about a bodybuilder and a woman who falls in love with her, and they kind of go on a bit of a crime spree. It's also a bit of a revenge thriller. Just so much fun. Like so much fun. We don't get movies like this anymore. And I'm thinking back to like the cool, you know, 90s crime thrillers from Paul Verhoeven and stuff like that. This is a wild movie. Like I love crime thrillers. I love movies that allow characters, you know, to be sexy if they want to be. Like it has a very specific vibe.
Yeah.
I recently rewatched Roadhouse, which is like the most male-gazy movie to ever exist. And that movie's a lot of fun, but this is almost the complete opposite because we just spend so much time ogling Katie O'Brien and her super jacked muscles. The woman is basically She-Hulk, and that is actually kind of related to what happens in the movie too. So anyway, great film. Ton of fun. Worst thing in the theaters, but it'll probably be on video on demand soon somewhere. Cannot recommend it enough. This is one of the most like wild films I've seen in years. I think you'd appreciate it, Trillin.
I've seen some of the trailers, and like as a person
great
who
trailers
goes to the gym a lot.
Huh? Yeah.
There are trailers, right?
There are great trailers. Yeah. Like I'm saying great trailers.
Sorry. I know. Yeah, I've seen these trailers. I've seen like Kristen Stewart do some interviews around this. So I've already been, it's on my radar, right? But like for me, the draw was, like you said, Katie O'Brien's muscles. Cause I'm, again, muscles. Like I'm someone who's here trying to, you know, develop my own gun show. And like she's got a permanent 24/7 gun show, right? Mine's she only is, like when I turn it on.
She's locked and loaded. Yeah.
Yeah. She's like, you know, primed, and she looks great and like a role model for me in terms of like physicality sometimes. But I'm also intrigued because like Kristen Stewart seems to have come a very long way from her Twilight days. You know, that's not a very fair thing.
Great forever. She has been great forever. Yeah, Twilight
exactly.
was a
it's
decade
not,
ago.
It's very long since, but like it just feels like she's truly coming out of her shell with this role. And I don't know. I quite enjoyed like her embracing.
You got to see
role.
More Kristen Stewart movies because she's been doing this for a
while. Yes. Like
I would also recommend.
What was it? Cherry Bomb? Was it though? What was that
Cherry
one?
Cherry Bomb. I've not seen that one. I think that there are a lot of indie
flavor?
Movies I have
no.
not seen. The movie, the David Cronenberg movie, Crimes of the Future, where she's just a little weirdo. Just a little weirdo
that's quite her
who's obsessed
too.
With that's very her. I think you'd like that movie because it's also gross as hell and also just weird. And Viggo Mortensen stars as like a very interesting character in that. So that is also another fun
Do
movie. Anyway, I love this movie. Love Lies Bleeding. Check it out in theaters and hopefully it'll be streaming somewhere soon.
Well, that's it for our episode this week, everyone. Thank you as always for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. This podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter, Mastodon, Blue Sky. I podcast about movies and TV at The Filmcast at thefilmcast.com. I also hosted Twit this week, so check that out, twit.tv with Scott Stein and a whole bunch of great folks. So yeah, go check out that too.
If you want to send me examples of the most egregious and embarrassing photo manipulation fails over the years, you can send them to me on, I guess, Twitter at Sherlyn Low, CHERLYNNLOW. You can send them to me on Threads at Sherlinstagram, or just email me, CHERLYNN@engadget.com. Email us your thoughts at podcast@engadget.com for the whole team to see it. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes, and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. I spent the night at the Sherzium, you know, I spent at home. It was exactly.